Thank you, gentlemen. We have four cases on the calendar this morning. A case from the Court of Veterans Appeals, a case from the Patent Office, a vaccine case from the Court of Federal Claims, and then a government employee case, which will not be argued and will be submitted on the briefs. In addition, after the first two cases, we will adjourn briefly, maybe not so briefly, and return with a somewhat modified panel. The break may constitute up to a half hour, for which we apologize, but it's unavoidable, and we would ask you to at least counsel for the Antoine Media case to stay close, and we will return as soon as we can. First case is Clyde Harriman versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, 2001-71-41. Ms. Booth. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. If it pleases the Court, my name is Sandra Booth. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Clyde Harriman. The first issue with respect to the 1952 rating decision and the CUE request revision turns on the following. Mr. Harriman filed a CUE request for revision in 2000 alleging that the 1952 rating decision failed to adjudicate a reasonably raised claim based on his his head injury, traumatic head injury, and post-concussion syndrome. The VA regional office denied...
He's been given 100% disability, hasn't he?
He does.
So this is a question of service connection. This is not an earlier date.
An earlier date. Yes.
And hasn't it been found that there was no Q, which is a fact question anyway? So why do we have jurisdiction with respect to the 1952 head injury?
Because, Your Honor, what we contend that the VA regional office, or that the agency, has never made an adjudication of CUE based on the failure to adjudicate theory developed by Roberson and its progeny. The veteran did certainly make that claim in 2000, but the agency construed it as a duty to assist theory and denied it very correctly under a duty to assist theory because, as this court's Cook decision, en banc Cook decision held, a breach of the duty to assist is not remediated by the CUE procedure.
I understand the core of your argument on this, and it's based, I suppose, on principally, at least on the paragraph on Appendix 68 that refers to reasons and bases and contains a reference to the duty to assist. It's the next to last paragraph on that page. And I think, if I understand your argument, is that that's the point at which the agency is focusing in on what it deems to be the claimed issue, which
yes.
You say was not failure to adjudicate, even though failure to adjudicate had been the basis for the claim.
Well, failure to adjudicate and duty to assist are two disparate theories.
I understand. The question is, did the agency in this 2000 ruling address the failure to adjudicate? And if it did, then we're finished. And if it didn't, then you say that does not foreclose the current Q claim.
Well, in my view, it did not, because the duty to assist theory, again, is separate as a matter of law from the duty to adjudicate.
But we really have it. Where I'm going with this is the discussion in the next to last paragraph is clearly a discussion of duty to assist. So to that extent, that does seem to be focused on duty to assist. But the last paragraph looks to me as if that is focused on the question of whether there was anything in the 52 claim that to adjudicate, and the conclusion was no, and therefore that would seem to address the failure to adjudicate, would it not?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the agency at that point failed to address the sympathetic reading requirement, which would have been part and parcel of a failure to adjudicate theory, unrelated, of course, to the duty to assist theory. So the observation that the medical records did not did show that he sustained head injuries, would actually support the failure to adjudicate, but the agency doesn't get there. The agency doesn't discuss it. And certainly, though, the board, I think, later discusses that the agency found that there was no claim made. But again, it applies an incorrect legal standard for the failure to adjudicate theory, because whether there was a claim articulated is not the correct standard. The correct standard is whether there was a claim taking into consideration not only the veteran's specific assertions, but also the evidence that is before the VA.
Well, but isn't that exactly what they did? They may not have done it in great detail, but what was the point of talking about what the medical records showed versus what they did not show if they really weren't addressing the failure to adjudicate claim?
Well, the service medical records, whether they indicated any residual disability would be relevant to whether the veteran had a current disability at the time he filed his claim. It would not be relevant to whether or not he had a claim for the head injury and the resulting from his combat trauma. So I think that the sentence that follows that is more telling, that there was no disability claimed as a direct result of his head injuries until June 1994. Under the failure to adjudicate, it's not required that he make, that he articulate that claim. So by virtue of the agency not addressing any of those issues that are relevant to the failure to adjudicate,
couldn't that just be a factual point to support the notion that there was nothing in the medical records that showed a current injury, and then saying, and on top of that, he never made an actual claim until much later, so it supports the notion that the medical records don't show that injury.
Well, if he didn't have a current injury, then the appropriate step, assuming that, and again, we've never had a finding of fact on whether or not this is a failure to adjudicate based on the Robertson standard, so, but let's assume that he did have, the evidence was, did support that there was a claim, then the board would have, or the agency would have at least had to make an adjudication of that.
What about the 1979 claim for a secondary service connection, for a hot connection? Hasn't that been remanded, and so isn't that non-final?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It was remanded, not the 1979 claim. The issue in the 1979 claim is whether or not it is even final, and the court has held that, that it is.
Well, what was remanded?
The veteran requested reopening of that claim around, I think, 2006, unknown to me when I got involved in this case. So we were had two claims.
It was unknown to me when you got involved in this. That doesn't matter.
But what I'm saying is we have two somewhat connected claims, one for attacking the finality of the 1979 rating decision, and the other requesting reopening. So the VA regional office did reopen the 2006 claim, denied it on the merits on in 2007.
Was that for a heart condition?
That was for a heart condition, yes. The veteran did appeal that. The board dismissed it on the grounds that the veteran did not present any argument. In fact, argument was presented about the adequacy of the agency's medical opinion developed in connection with the reopened claim. And that's the matter that Chief Judge Castle set aside the board's dismissal, remanded for the board to make a decision.
Why doesn't the decision letter on page 882 of the joint appendix, which addressed the newly submitted evidence, why doesn't that render the 1979 decision final?
Because it doesn't address, it renders it final as to his anxiety. It also references a foot condition for which he's service-connected at, although I'm not sure why that, mm-hmm. that's even relevant. But it doesn't make any reference to his cardiac claim.
Well, the cardiac claim had been referenced in the initial decision.
Correct.
And rejected. And if I read, and it was a little difficult to read, but I think I translated it correctly, I read the doctor's progress notes on 83 through 85, and that reads to me like a medical history in which there was no further finding of anything beyond simply noting his medical history and then noting that Dr. Trask had made the finding that his letter indicates he made. Where is the evidence that is supplemental, new evidence of a cardiac problem in that medical history?
Whether there is no other evidence at that time period, and we're not arguing that his evidence was new and material. What we are contending is, and the court's recent decision in Bond supports this very strongly, is that any time VA receives a submission of new evidence during that 3.156B time period, which is 1 year after the rating decision or at any time before the final appellate decision is made, and this qualifies, VA must make a determination.
Right, and they did. And your problem is, well, they didn't make a determination that specifically referenced the cardiac issue.
Correct.
So if they had written down here, cardiac, we also continue to reject the cardiac claim.
Mm-hmm.
Then that would be clearly final, right?
Well, not unless it would not be final if the veteran then decided to address the
if that was the end of the matter, then we wouldn't be here arguing about finality.
I think that's correct.
So the question is, since there was a response, the question is, was there anything in the new material, if there had been no reference in the new material to anything having to do with cardiac condition, then they wouldn't have to respond, and we continue to reject the cardiac condition argument, right?
Well, we get into a very factual, in practice that would be a very particular factual argument to make as to whether or not the veteran thought it had something to do with his claim or whether VA thinks it has something to do with a claim. In this case, because it does reference his cardiac condition as related to his anxiety, his service-connected anxiety, the VA at least had to make a determination. Now, there's nothing about the cardiac claim in that June 1979 letter that you're referring to, and I don't think it comes within the deemed denied provisions, particularly the interpretation of the Veterans Court in the Ingram case, which this court cited with approval in Adams. And Ingram said that in determining whether there are two claims pending, in determining whether the denial of one was a denial of the other, you have to look at the reasons VA gave for denying that claim. So again, if you look here at the reasons, in the Ingram case, the VA denied pension and told him it wasn't permanent, and the Veterans Court said that's not a denial of his 1151 claim, which is a medical negligence claim because the permanency has nothing to do with medical negligence.
I need to go back, though. I don't think you've answered Judge Bryson's question, and that's what's troubling me here.
All right.
Is that what in the new submission, the interim submission before this second rejection letter, where does that new submission contain medical evidence of the cardiac condition and its connection to the nervous condition?
I don't think it contains anything that's new and material. It is later in time, so it's new in that regard. I don't think it's material. But the veteran had to know that. The veteran was entitled to be informed of that. That's what Bond says, that no matter whenever a submission is made during the appeal period, which this is, the question for 3.156B is whether the evidence is new and material and not whether the claimant calls it that. But then when I say...
So you're saying that, for instance, if the veteran has a claim for, you know, head injuries, a heart problem, and foot problem, and then after the initial rejection, he submits some medical records relating to the foot problem, and you're saying that the VA has to then go back and say, not only did we reject your request for anything relating to your foot problem, but we re-reject your request as to the things that the medical records don't relate to.
As the regulation is written and as Bond construed it, I would say that is correct. I do think VA could appropriately amend its regulation, revise its regulation to limit that that duty to evidence that specifically addresses a particular claim. But they haven't done that. And so as the regulation is written right now, yes, I would say that's correct. Any submission of evidence within that one-year time period would generate the requirement to provide notice.
Ms. Booth, as you can see, you've just about assumed your rebuttal time, but we've asked you questions. We'll give you 3 minutes back.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Ms. Hosford, you need a couple of extra minutes. You may have them.
May it please the Court, with respect to the 1952 claim, this Court lacks jurisdiction to hear Mr. Harriman's argument on appeal because review of the Veterans Court's consideration of the race judicata issue would require an application of law to fact, which is not within the scope of your jurisdiction under Section 7292D2.
So you're saying we lack jurisdiction on that claim for two reasons?
Well, for one reason, because 7292D2 precludes the Court from considering an application of law to fact, which is exactly what the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims did in this case and the Board. They said the 2006 claim was not new because it was looking at that claim and comparing it to the 2000 claim, they were virtually identical. So this Court doesn't have jurisdiction over the content of a claim. In her reply brief,
but whether race judicata applies is a legal conclusion, is it not?
That's the argument that Mr. Harriman made in his reply brief, but you have to look at the cases that were cited. That Chromalloy case cites the Faust decision. Remember, these are Chromalloy was a patent case where 7292 didn't apply. In the Faust decision, the Court expressly acknowledged that in determining whether there's race judicata, you have to look at the facts. So it's an application of law to fact. So
Didn't we just say this year in Newgard that if it's a determination of whether race judicata acts as a bar, that that's a determination that this Court has jurisdiction to make and then proceed to make that determination?
In that case, the Court was determining whether race judicata even applied to a Q claim. It wasn't whether race judicata was correctly applied.
But we ultimately affirmed that it was correctly applied. We actually exercised jurisdiction over it, did we not?
So you're saying we should affirm, not dismiss that aspect of the claim?
The Court should find it has no jurisdiction over the question of whether there was race judicata between the 2000 and 2006 claims. I mean, my understanding of the Newgard case...
If race judicata is a question of law, you would say we should affirm.
If it's a question of law, well, you should definitely... The Court has no jurisdiction, but assuming there is jurisdiction, the Court should affirm.
Right.
And there's a couple of reasons for that. The record is clear that the claims made in 2000 and 2006 were virtually identical. Judge Bryson pointed out that in both on J82 and 2000, as well as in 2006, the rating office, or the regional office, considered the direct question of whether or not Mr. Harriman had raised a claim of disability based on head injury in 1952. In both cases, it found that he did not. Mr. Harriman likes to focus on that second to last paragraph on page 82, which talks about the duty to assist. But that's not really relevant. I mean, even under the line of cases that Mr. Harriman is trying to rely on, the Smeraj, Moody, Andrews, the fact that The fact that the regional office has to sympathetically read a claim doesn't mean that Hugh can be based on an ultimate failure to develop that claim or, you know, order a medical report or anything else that would fall under the duty to assist. In this case,
how do you respond to your sister's argument that, in fact, that last paragraph that is too cryptic to actually constitute a decision on the failure to adjudicate?
I don't believe that paragraph is too cryptic. And you have to read it in context of the entire, of the last two paragraphs. First, the rating office cited Hugo v. Brown. That case applies both to duty to assist and whether or not there's been a development of a claim. And it acknowledges that, at that time, a development of a claim could be a basis for Q if you had persuasive evidence. It then goes on to say, and we have to look at it in the context of Hugo, service medical records did show the veteran sustained head injuries but did not indicate any residual disability. My colleague was saying something about residual disability doesn't mean that he had a disability. I wasn't sure I followed that argument, but this is exactly what the sympathetic reading requirement mandates of the regional office. They looked at the record to see whether or not there was any residual harm or disability claimed in 1952 when he brought his claim for a nervous disorder. They said the record only showed that he had he'd been hit in the head while he was in service, that he had headaches during service. There was no claim of any kind about any sort of residual disability after service when he made his claim for service connection.
And by claim, you're using the term claim broadly to mean any indication in any medical record or otherwise, as opposed to assertion made by him at the time.
Exactly. If you look at pages 108 through 111 of the Joint Appendix, and you look at the medical report that was done in connection with his October 1952 claim, it says that everything was normal, including his head, there were no complaints of any problems with his head. The only complaint that had been made was when he was in service in the hospital saying he had headaches. There was no residual disability claimed at the time he actually filed his application for benefits.
So that last sentence of the last paragraph,
Reflects that finding
as opposed to a finding that we are looking solely to the point in time that an actual formal claim was made.
Correct. They looked at the records, and the only source of any problem with Mr. Harriman's head was while he was in the hospital, during service, and it was headaches. They looked at the entire record. And in 2006, same exact determination was made. That's why the board said you claim no new theory of here. And so there was a res judicata, and that's what the Veterans Court found. The only other argument that Mr. Harriman made in his brief on this is that he claimed that the 2000 request for Q was actually addressing a 1995 decision rather than the 1952 decision, but the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims expressly addressed that argument and rejected it. That was a finding of fact. That's not within the court's jurisdiction. And if you look at the documents, it's clear that the claim in 2000 was for Q based on the 1952 decision, and that the 2000 decision denying that claim for Q was also addressed to 1952.
What about the hot condition?
Okay, moving on to the finality argument. We would agree with what Judge Bryson and Judge Lurie were implying, that the record of 1979 of Mr. Harriman's submission of additional evidence does not show that he was making an additional claim based upon the his claim for secondary service for heart condition. Mr. Harriman's counsel has admitted that the record didn't reflect that there was any further request for consideration of the heart condition. Regional office found that, and the board found that. However, we would also argue that the court doesn't even need to get to that issue. What Mr. Harriman is claiming here is that there was never a finding made as to whether or not the evidence he submitted in April 1979 was new and material as to his alleged heart condition. The board, in 2008, expressly, at JA 26, expressly decided that issue. It said, Mr. Harriman argued that the that the VA never decided whether his evidence submitted in April 1979 was new material as to the heart condition.
That's the
September 15, 2008
board decision?
Yes.
Well, isn't that the board decision that is ultimately under review here?
Right, that the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims said, said Mr. Harriman, you never appealed that, nor do you allege error in that finding. So Mr. Harriman never appealed that finding when he went to the Veterans Court, and that finding stands, and there's no error in it. There's no allegation of error in that finding even today.
Mm-hmm.
All that Mr. Harriman claims is that in 1979 he never got a final answer on whether or not his evidence was new material. Well, even after the Court's bond decision, that evidence is dispositive.
Well, what about the bond case and the interpretation of regulation? Your opposing counsel argues that the regulation requires, in a situation in which multiple claims have been made and rejected, but new evidence comes in, that any further communication from the agency, as I understood her argument, any further communication from the agency must address all of the claims initially made and rejected, even if the new evidence does not include new evidence that's pertinent to one or more of the claims.
A very narrow reading of bond could support that argument. But you have to look at the facts of bond. In bond, Mr. Bond was ultimately, a couple of years later, awarded service connection for the disability that he said was the subject of new material evidence, but he was not given service connection back to the original claim. And the court ultimately found that because this new material evidence related to the entirety of your first claim, the VA had to at least determine whether it was new material for purposes of all the claims he made. That's our reading of bond. That was not the position we took before the court in that case, but what I would argue here is that the court doesn't even need to reach that issue because the March 2008 board decision expressly found that the evidence submitted in April 1979 was not new material as to the heart condition. At best, bond cast some doubt on the whole implicit denial argument that we were making.
So is being new and material evidence satisfying that test a predicate for entitlement to a further decision on a claim in which you submitted new evidence in the one-year period after the original rejection?
Yes.
Okay.
If it's new material, then it relates back to the claim that was decided.
But if it's not material, then no obligation to respond at all.
Or you can construe, to the extent that the veteran comes back and says, I want you to consider the heart condition, then it would be considered a new claim for the heart condition. It wouldn't relate back. Once it's decided that the evidence is not new material, if the veteran wants to reopen the heart condition, then he has to file a new informal claim for consideration of the heart condition and try to allege some other basis. But you're not going to get an effective date back to the original claim. It's all about effective date. That's what really Bond was focused on.
Yeah.
So the only other issue that is before the court, which really wasn't discussed during Mr. Harriman's counsel's argument, is the whole question of whether or not there were two in 1979 decision. Our argument is that requires a consideration of the weighing of the evidence that's not within the court's jurisdiction. Mr. Harriman argued that in reliance upon the Boughton decision, that because there was only one opinion of nexus in the record, the court has to find that it was adequate, that's not applicable in this case because not only did the opinion nexus, the board found that although the opinion addressed nexus, it was addressing it in the context of a proximate cause standard. Proximate cause standard, and the evidence was supported at best aggravation of the heart condition. And to the extent that Mr. Harriman argues that no rationale was required in support of a medical opinion in 1979, that's just not supported. He cited regulations. in his reply brief, Mr. Harriman said, well, that regulation says if it's inadequate, you have to send it back. But here, we not only had the inadequacy of the rationale, but we also had the finding of no proximate cause, and instead, at best, aggravation. Unless the court has other questions, we would ask that it be different.
Thank you, Ms. Crawford. Ms. Booth has 3 minutes for rebuttal time.
Thank you for the extra time, Your Honor. Just a quick couple of remarks. Number one, regarding the March 2008 EVA finding that the evidence was not new and material, that's absolutely irrelevant. The board has no jurisdiction over the 1979 decision. A determination was not made. Consequently, a notice of disagreement was not filed, and a notice of disagreement is a condition preceding to board jurisdiction. Further, even if an argument could be made that the board had, in 2008, had jurisdiction to decide if the 1979 evidence was new and material, the board cannot, as a matter of law, make that decision unless the veteran waives his right to have new evidence initially considered at the VA regional office level. I believe that's the court's DAV case interpreting the VA's regs. And I did not cite that in the brief, but I will file a supplemental citation upon my return to the office. The veteran never waived his entitlement to have initial consideration of new evidence at the regional office level, so it's absolutely irrelevant what the board found on the nature of the evidence.
Is it true that the obligation, the secretary's obligation to file a subsequent denial of a claim when new evidence has been submitted depends upon whether that new evidence that's submitted within a year satisfies the new and material evidence standard?
No, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. The agency always has an obligation to tell the veteran what its determination was, even if it's not favorable to the veteran, and perhaps even more importantly, when it's not favorable to the veteran. The notice obligation arises under 38 CFR 3.103E in 1979. Substantially the same language is in paragraph A today, 3.103A, and it specifically requires the secretary to give notice of any determination affecting the payment of benefits. The veteran, the VA must not only tell the veteran of the decision, but also the reasons,
okay,
the right to appeal.
Okay, the question is what flows as a consequence from the failure to respond to the veteran's subsequent submission. I mean, suppose that the veteran files a subsequent submission that we could all agree just plainly does not include anything that a reasonable person would consider to be new and material evidence with respect to a particular claim. Now, does the VA just doesn't submit anything back to the veteran saying we continue to not deny your claim. Does that mean that claim remains open for all time, or at least until?
I would see that as being the case under the bond interpretation, because the failure to, once you make the VA has to make that determination that this evidence is so lacking that it has no value whatsoever. They've got to make that decision. What bond says, or rather what the regulation then says, is that you have to tell the veteran about that decision. Even if he's got a crazy idea, you got to tell him it's a crazy idea. Charles, my time's about up, but I would refer the court also to the Charles case, which specifically said that under a 3.156B case, since the case had to go back for a new determination, the issuance of a supplemental statement of the case in that case, but procedurally, whatever the vehicle is, Charles plainly supports that the VA must give notice, and until that notice is given, finality is interrupted.
That was actually raises another question that I had, and I'm not sure when the various procedural requirements came into play temporally from the beginning of the VA compensation system until now, but when did the supplemental statement of the case and, well, for that matter, even statement of the case obligation to come into play? Because, for example, the original 1979 ruling doesn't contain what we would now look for as a statement of the case. So it was just a rating decision, unless we are missing something here on the record. When did that obligation come into play?
The rating decision itself need not... Well, I'm referring to a technical term in the art, the statement of the case, which
right.
is the document filed after a notice of disagreement.
Right, but and there was no notice of disagreement here.
Right, correct.
So no statement of the case required.
No statement
and therefore
of the case.
No supplemental statement of the case.
Right, right. But the procedural vehicle in where the case is not in appellate status, I would think would be, it could be something as simple as a letter, which is what the VA did
right.
with respect to the anxiety
But claim. Do you happen to know when the statement of the case and supplemental statement of the case requirements came into the system at all? Because I was sort of confused when I read Charles and saw a reference to supplemental statement of the case.
I'm a little bit confused by that, too. It did not seem to track with the procedure in Charles. But I think my take on what the court was saying in Charles was that you have to make a decision and the court identified
well, yeah, no decision at all in Charles.
Right.
Right, okay. But you're not arguing that the problem here was not, you're not arguing that the problem here was there was no supplemental statement in the case because there was no nod.
There was no statement of the case to start with.
Right.
Right. So
right.
There would not
the problem is that the response that came in June should have, at minimum, adverted to the cardiac complaint.
Right. Should have so informed the veteran that the cardiac was
thank
also...
thank you, Ms. Booth. We'll
thank
take
you.
The case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.